This is The Takeaway for Monday, February 27th, 2017.
The Academy Award for Best Picture.
You're impossible.
Come on.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and forget the Oscars, folks. I mean, just forget them. They make this gigantic, unthinkable mistake while hundreds of millions of people around the world are watching. And then they just say, oops, never mind, and declare another winner and go on with the show.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Wow. Imagine if you could do that in other places, in life, in politics. Like I said, forget the Oscars. We begin this hour and week in Washington, D.C., where the president is busy keeping news organizations out of the loop and announcing he won't go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He's spending time with friendly governors. The mostly Republican state leaders are in D.C. to ask questions about some costly uncertainties in the Trump first month of policy declarations. Meanwhile, Democrats elected new leaders who vowed to adopt a more local strategy, having left local races to the GOP for decades. The Takeaway is Todd Zwillick starts us off with the president in very friendly territory.
I mean, this is a president in the first month or two of his term here who likes to surround himself with supporters when he can, because inside the Beltway in Washington, it seems, in his battles with the press, in his battles with Congress, even some Republicans in Congress, although not that many, he might be a president without a lot of friends. Lots of the governors in Washington over the weekend, and there are lots of issues, but hey, the big one, the big issue with governors, Republican and Democrat, not only with the president, but today on Capitol Hill, is the fate of Medicaid and the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. We're on the cusp of March here, and that's the month that Hill Republicans say their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare is coming out. Now, those exchanges and people with individual insurance, that's a big part of the ACA and people who gained insurance or might lose it when Republicans change this program. But 12 million people gained insurance under the Medicaid expansion in states that took it. And there are governors from those states, Republicans and Democrats, carrying a message to Hill Republicans and to the president to not do away with that expansion as they devolve more power to the states, and say in the plans that we've seen so far, they're going to cut some of that money. Those governors do not want that money cut. And there is a split among Republican ranks now between legislators and those state governors, those executives, about how much to cut and how to structure those programs.
Very quickly, over the weekend, a lot of wish lists were floating around. There was a wish list from the governors for the president wanting some of that infrastructure money that he seems to be promising. And there were wish list after wish list after wish list for what the DNC is going to do now that it has new leadership. Any idea that these wishes can come true?
Well, look, on infrastructure, it looks like a congressional fight over Donald Trump's promises on infrastructure might get kicked until next year. Congress is moving at a snail's pace. They basically haven't passed any legislation yet, as the Senate's been tied up over fights over cabinet nominees. There's a Supreme Court nomination coming up this spring and summer, as you know, and they're getting to work on Obamacare repeal and replace, which Democrats will try to make go very, very slowly. Look, there was some putative agreement between Donald Trump and Democrats. Hey, big infrastructure program. There is absolutely no agreement on how to actually do that. And now that you mentioned the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, and new leadership, Tom Perez, the former Labor Secretary, elected head of the DNC, barely over Congressman Keith Ellison over the weekend. John, if Tom Perez has any mandate, it's two things. One is to try to staunch the bleeding and get back some Democratic credibility in the nearly 1,000 state and local seats that Democrats lost under President Obama.
Well, get us some governors. Get us some congressmen and women, for heaven's sakes.
And people in state legislatures, yeah. And even on the local level.
Exactly.
I mean, it's been an absolute bloodbath for Democrats. That's one part of his mandate. The other, and it became pretty clear in this really close race between the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, represented by Ellison, and the liberal slash establishment wing, represented by Tom Perez, because he's pretty liberal too, it's opposition to Donald Trump. I mean, the message has been sent to the Chuck Schumers and people on the Hill who thought they might find areas of cooperation with Donald Trump and Hill Republicans. No, they want staunch opposition. The DNC election has proven that. And so those are the two main parts of that mandate, wish lists or not.
And the question is, do they have the ability to make that local mandate work, the building up of the Democratic, sort of coffers and credibility at the local level? I mean, is that something that these guys can do?
Well, look, we've had Howard Dean on the show more than once, the famous architect of the 50-state strategy. Many Democrats feel that that's been completely abandoned. I mean, look at the proof. We talked about that 900-and-something elected seats lost. Tom Perez has promised to go back to the local strategy. Not only, he said, to compete in every state, he said in every single zip code. Democrats are crying out for credibility on the local level. Look, they won the popular vote. They believe they have more voters than Republicans across the country. Why are we losing in district after district? You can only make so many excuses for funny district shapes and gerrymandering. Yeah, that's a factor, but that doesn't explain every single state legislature, local race, and governorship that they haven't managed to win. Bernie Sanders has proven the power of individual internet-based fundraising that doesn't have to go through a massive party structure. Can Democrats revamp their fundraising culture to capture some of that Bernie Sanders magic?
Donald Trump spending time with friendlies, Democrats looking for friendlies. That's the message as the week begins. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
As 9/11 metaphors go, the one in the conservative Claremont Review of Books in early September, the Flight 93 election, has to go down as a classic. Under a dorky pen name, conservative intellectual Michael Anton argued that Hillary Clinton was the Flight 93 piloted by maniacs bent on destroying America, and electing Donald Trump was the storming of the cockpit. But instead of crashing in this metaphor, Flight 93 is piloted heroically out of danger. Michael Anton wrote this view of the Trump revolution, arguing that something has to stop, quote, the ceaseless importation of third world foreigners with no tradition of, taste for, or experience in liberty. Michael Anton is now a powerful member of the National Security Council, whose job it is to make coherent a so far hard to decipher foreign policy. Anton loves Machiavelli, by the way, and philosopher Leo Strauss. They both believe power trumps everything to maintain an ideal society. Tina Nguyen profiled Michael Anton for Vanity Fair's Hive, and she sees his impact and fingerprints on lots of the confusing rhetoric coming out of the White House.
Michael Anton has the clout of conservative intelligentsia behind him. When you were looking at the Reagan administration, he had National Review, Weekly Standard. Bush was more Weekly Standard, actually. But if you want to have someone who can articulate the reason that conservative principles are completely in line with Trumpism, even though Trump sounds more populist and slightly more socialist, if you want to argue that, then you look to Michael Anton. You look to the people who wrote in this defunct academic journal called the Journal of American Greatness, which was all synonymous authors writing very academic, intellectual arguments for why Trump is perfectly okay and Trump is acceptable.
And if we come from the very famous piece that Michael Anton wrote for the Claremont Journal, that
Claremont Review of
the
Books,
Claremont Review of Books that really got him on the radar, is that Trump is okay because he blows everything up. That's as much the issue as anything about Trump. That if Trump was another kind of blunt instrument, that would work just as well, except Trump, because it takes down the establishment, including Hillary Clinton.
Pretty much, yeah. The way that Anton framed it in this essay was, Hillary Clinton will definitely destroy America, full stop. She'll turn it into this administrative state where she will let more immigrants in and dilute American values.
And she compared it to Flight 93, the 9/11 flight that didn't make it to Washington.
Yes. And you either charge the cockpit or you die. That is a direct quote.
So does Anton believe that Trump is the future, or does Anton believe that Trump will permit Anton and his ideological cronies to actually run things?
I asked this question to Anton, and he said that his viewpoint and Trump's viewpoints do align, except that Trump is not as academically articulate as he is. I mean, that he defers to Trump. Trump is his boss. Anton has been a speechwriting communications professional for years, and I've never got the impression that he would try to bend his boss's agenda to his whim. It's just that they happen to overlap. Their ideas just happen to overlap completely.
Who found Anton and thought, oh, he'd be perfect in the National Security Council?
Peter Thiel, actually.
The billionaire Silicon Valley conservative.
Yes, the one who supports Donald Trump and just like shocked everyone when he came out and said, hey, you know what? Trump seems to be great and could possibly help me implement my ideas for libertarian utopia.
And so Thiel said, but Trump needs some seasoning, needs some intellectual heft, and Anton is the guy for that.
Well, Anton does have experience on the National Security Council. He wrote speeches for Condoleezza Rice. He was there for a lot of the Bush administration time. And between then and now, he had some sort of anti-elitist awakening, as it were. But he and Thiel actually go way back. He told me that he met Peter Thiel when he, Anton, was an undergraduate at Berkeley and Thiel was at Stanford Law. And I assume that back in the day when you're a bunch of conservatives in the Bay Area and everyone's just bearing down on you, you kind of find your way to hang out. They lost touch over the years. And then when Thiel found that he was the author of this essay, he introduced Anton to the Trump transition team. The Trump transition team had already appointed Monica Crowley to take Anton's position. Then she got kicked out because of a plagiarism scandal, and Anton got brought in. And Anton just happens to have a lot of experience as a speechwriting professional, a lot of experience working on national security, and he also has this ideology. It's just a perfect storm.
Is Anton there to push a particular national security agenda, or is his skill in taking what seems a little chaotic coming out of the White House and turning it into some coherent message?
I would definitely say it's the latter. The point of the position on the National Security Council is to serve as a clearinghouse for all the messaging coming from all these different departments, largely state, defense, and all of the intelligence community's messaging. So, of course, you have things like, okay, what are the spokespeople at any given time going to say from these agencies? What are the ambassadors going to say? And then, like, smaller things, too. I spoke to someone who served on the Obama administration's National Security Council, and the best way you could describe it is that Anton has Ben Rhodes' position. Ben was the communications manager for the National Security Council, and he infamously became notorious for bragging that he had packaged the messaging that sold the American public and the international community on the benefits of the Iran nuclear deal. So that gives you an idea of the scope of what Anton could do.
Tina Nguyen is the staff reporter for Vanity Fair's Hive. Thanks so much, Tina.
Thank you for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Constant Contact, offering email marketing features like drag-and-drop editing and mobile-friendly templates. Constant Contact's products are focused on helping small businesses. More at ConstantContact.com.
Once a bustling industrial center that manufactured combat boots, Olathe, Kansas hit the skids in the 1970s, and its nearly all-white population began to change in the 1980s. In the mid-90s, the city became a tech center when the Garmin Company located there. The tech mapping and GPS app giant attracted educated workers from all around the world. Suddenly, Olathe became a center for South Asian culture. Indian food and music, lots of ambitious South Asian families helped to make the public schools some of the best in the state and the country. Last week, an attacker went into a bar, yelled, "Get out of my country," pulled the trigger, and killed Indian Srinivas Kuchibotla. The shooter injured Alok Madasani. A young white male, Ian Griot, was also injured when he tried to stop the shooter. You haven't heard much about this because the U.S. government hasn't made it a priority. The president has been silent, and the media has been distracted by the president's other headlines. But it is a sad time for Tapash Chakraborty and his 15-year-old daughter, Jania Chakraborty. They know the dead man from a local cricket league and are wondering just what America they are living in right now.
I've never felt blatant discrimination like this tragedy was. It's never occurred to me that people could resent someone for something like this, that they were, that Srinivas was just trying to achieve his dreams and work hard, and this could happen to him. It never occurred to me in such a place close to home.
And now, Tapash, this is a global incident. This has involved people in India, and there's outrage from here to the other side of the world.
Yes, that is true. Actually, I think the outrage is more back in India than over here even. I feel like people in India felt that this is, should not have happened. You know, they're kind of really angry about it. This is the headline news, you know. This is the headline news on all the newspaper in India.
Jania, there are communities all over America that are high-tech communities with immigrants of all types working in prosperous communities like Olathe and Overland Park. What do you need to hear to feel secure as a young person growing up in America?
I need to hear that maybe we start younger and go to the elementary schools and educate them on, just because I feel like this was an act of just ignorance and just racism, and this should be taught on from earlier, like an earlier age, that this is wrong and this cannot happen. And the fact that Indian communities or whatever other race who are living in America and trying to make something for themselves are not making any mistake, that they are here for a good reason and they deserve to be here.
Why is it that a 15-year-old girl can say that to a national audience on this radio program, but we haven't heard anything from the White House?
I really feel outraged and shocked that we haven't. I think that I live in Overland Park and I can see that this has happened and it's affecting me on a local level. And I'm part of a cultural, like a diverse house, that I go to school, I go to public school, and I'm very American in that sense. But I also come home to an Indian house, and I'm bilingual. I appreciate the culture. I don't have prejudice against anyone, Indian or other races. And I feel like there might be some prejudice in the White House that maybe that these people don't deserve to be here, and they're immigrants, and they're taking our jobs, when that's not the case. Srinivas Kuchi Bhatla, pardon my pronunciation, he was more American than the killer, I would say, because he came to America respecting people. He was a good person. He worked hard for what he believed in. And the killer who decided to become, he was inebriated and he walked into a bar screaming at someone. He did not represent any American ideal that I have learned of in my 15 years. He was not American in any way. And Alok Madasani and Srinivas Kuchi Bhatla, they represented the American ideals as I have learned them. They respected others. They did good for others. They worked hard. They had families that they cared for and they loved. And they were more American. And that is what America should be. It shouldn't be just for the color of your skin that you have the right to do any of this. Adam Perenvaut was not American. He did not represent any American ideals, and he decided to be a drunk racist who walked into a bar and hurt other people.
Tapash, there are Indians now, friends I'm sure of yours back in your country, who are saying, get the hell out of there. It's too scary. You're nuts for staying in America. What do you tell them?
Yeah, no. This is what I tell them. Hey, this is my country, actually. America is my country. I have been in this country for most of my prime time. Actually, pretty much all of my prime time, okay? So this is my country, and I am here for the good or bad, okay? It's not like I am going to get everything out of this country and, you know, settle back in India. That is not possible, because this is the country I have settled in, okay? This is my country. So we have to fight. Stay here, fight it, and make sure, you know, we get back our America. I tell my relatives back in India, hey, this is what we are, basically. We are Americans, and we are going to make sure that this incident don't happen, and we should work together to make America great again. Actually, this is not what we represent, actually.
Hey, Tapash, I'll take your view of American greatness any day of the week. You take care now.
Yeah. All right, thanks.
Tapash and Jania, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
He's been gone. Well, it'll be 18 years in March.
He would always have a smile on his face, just like everything was great. And you know, he was just dying inside.
It just seems like something's got to go wrong.
He's going to walk back out that door with us tomorrow, and we aren't going to be staying.
This will be it. Last time.
Hopefully, a big part of his life ahead of him.
It is going to be a ride.
It's just been so long. I keep waiting for him to come get me.
During the 8 years of Barack Obama, a huge sea change happened in America. Quietly, while fights over health care, climate change, and immigration would lead to gridlock, Republicans and Democrats together, at every level of government, came to the realization that the number of people in U.S. prisons represented a system run amok. Changing this would be among the biggest challenges facing this country in the 21st century. We will have to wait and see if the consensus holds during the next 4 years. But President Obama began this change by issuing clemency to 1,927 inmates, mostly nonviolent drug offenders in their 30s and 40s. They would be set free. Criminal justice experts say, as important as they are, they represent the least challenging cases needing prison reform. Nevertheless, the task before these inmates is hugely daunting. Aaron Glasscock is one of them.
Dear Aaron, I wanted to personally inform you that I am granting your application for commutation. The power to grant pardons and clemency is one of the most profound authorities granted to the President of the United States. It embodies the basic belief in our democracy that people deserve a second chance.
Back in 1999, prosecutors really wanted to put Aaron, a successful college student, away. He refused a plea deal, insisted he was innocent, and after four trials, two hung juries and a mistrial, and 2 months shy of graduating from college, he was convicted on a drug charge and sentenced to 30 years in federal prison. In our series, Commuted, Life After Prison, we will see what people like Aaron Glasscock are up against, transitioning from prison back to the real world. We'll find out if the system that worked so hard to take his life away will devote the effort to see that he succeeds, and to see if he and his family and loved ones can heal from what they all have been put through. Takeaway producer Dana Roberson brings us part one of this story.
It's Tuesday, February 7th.
It is almost 11 o'clock.
The night before Aaron Glasscock is due to be released from prison after nearly 18 years.
So it'd be about 6 hours and 50 minutes and we'll be out here picking you up.
His mother was counting down the minutes.
It is going to be a ride.
Agnes Deep, who goes by the nickname Pigeon, has been anxiously awaiting her son's release since the news of his commutation. She's a deputy at the county property valuation office, a mom of three. Her eldest son, a military veteran, is married with two girls. Her youngest is a working mom with a four-year-old daughter. Aaron is the middle child. As we sat there talking, she looked relieved, but tired. She said she was waiting for something to go wrong.
I asked my husband tonight, I said, there isn't anything anybody can do, is there? And he said, no. He says you can't override the president.
From the moment Pigeon learned that Aaron would be released, she jumped into mom gear for her now 40-year-old son.
I've got his toiletries and I've got his clothes all in a bag, belt, underwear, all different kinds of clothes, and the shirts and stuff. He's got like four different pants and they're all four different sizes. Because we don't know his size, because it's been so long since he's had pants. And you're going to love this one. It said not to get anything that had warning or caution on it. Well, have you ever looked at a shaving cream? They all have that on there. I got out the goat milk shaving cream and put it in the case for Aaron. Oh, yeah, that stuff's good.
Aaron's commutation will be a second chance for both him and his family, who have had their lives upended by his incarceration.
It's taken a toll, because where we had traditions before, family traditions, all those were gone. We've had to make new. Every holiday I spent with Aaron.
Pigeon drove me to her hometown of Lebanon, Kentucky, a small rural town in the heart of bourbon country. The family is tight-knit. Aaron grew up hunting and spending time outdoors. He had an early love of construction and started building houses with a family friend when he was a teenager. And because he's so good at using his hands, he wanted to become a pediatric surgeon.
When this happened with Aaron and he was arrested, I started crying. And I could not stop. When I got down there, before I saw him the first time, I said a prayer and I said, God, please, I don't want him to see me cry. Please. Because I couldn't stop. When I asked that and I stopped crying and I went into seeing, Aaron never saw me cry. He never heard me cry until the day he called and he told me that President Obama had commuted his sentence. And I broke down and I cried. And I did that for probably 2 weeks. Just be sitting there and just start crying. It's kind of hard for me to comprehend that he's going to walk back out that door with us tomorrow and we aren't going to be staying. I guess it won't fully hit until we get him in that car and it starts up and we leave.
When we continue the story tomorrow, we take the 2-hour drive in the car with Pigeon and her family as they head to the Manchester Federal Correctional Prison to pick up Aaron.
This will be the last time.
It just seems like something's got to go wrong, you know?
So it's been hard, especially with him not being here and being with me on special occasions.
That's tomorrow in part 2 of our story, Commuted, Life After Prison. And later in the week, we'll meet Aaron in his first few minutes of freedom.
When I was walking out, it was a little weird, but yeah. It's like, okay, if people looking at me.
Yeah.
They know I just got out of prison.
Reporting all week on the Glasscock family's tragedies and challenges, The Takeaway's Dana Roberson. To follow along with our series, head over to thetakeaway.org/lifeafterprison.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and the NBA is stepping up and firing from all over the league. I'm talking about how LeBron James and Steph Curry, Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr, and other players and coaches are making a point to speak out politically against the Trump style and tone. The NBA has always been the loudest voice in sports and activism. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, says, unlike the stodgy NFL, free speech is a participant sport in the NBA, a message that comes even from the head of the league.
The commissioner, Adam Silver, has a very different management style than the previous commissioner, David Stern, who is known for being very paternalistic, very top-down, and also very quick with the ruler on the knuckles if players spoke out about politics, while Adam Silver is someone who I think genuinely believes that civic-minded athletes are a good thing. I also think that this has gotten a little bit out of control for Adam Silver, and maybe he wishes he could pour some of the wine back in the bottle, but that's pretty tough to do.
In the era of Colin Kaepernick and the NFL, how would you say that incident and that issue and the question of him symbolically not standing for the national anthem played out differently than what's going on in the NBA right now?
See, when Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the anthem, one of the great questions throughout the sports world was, wow, if this happens in the button-down NFL and if this is spreading in the button-down NFL, what's it going to be like in the NBA where players are generally more outspoken? And Adam Silver underwent a very conscious strategy to try to head off the Kaepernick moment in the NBA by putting out memos to players saying, hey, we want you to be outspoken, just please keep it off the court and please don't do it during the anthem. They even put out NBA public service announcements that had the most outspoken players as spokespeople for the importance of police and community relations, people like Carmelo Anthony, Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade. And then Donald Trump gets elected president. And all of a sudden, all of this space that Silver accorded players all of a sudden became electric. And all of a sudden, these players, many of whom, remember, have seen the world. They've traveled the world. And so they don't have this visceral distrust or dislike of immigrants, of people of Muslim descent. So the Donald Trump agenda, I think, particularly rubs NBA players in a way that they want to push back. And Adam Silver afforded that space. I do think it's gotten out of control. You know, it's like the genie who's lost the ability to control his spells.
The NBA has always been known as having a more narrow demographic than the NFL. And right. NASCAR is the other example of having a narrow demographic. How do you think this plays out broadly among all sports, which, you know, play to their particular audiences?
Well, it's interesting that you are seeing anti-Trump sentiment at least reflect itself in all sports, which reflects Donald Trump's approval ratings. I mean, when you have someone like Dale Earnhardt Jr., who's just an icon and from the iconic family in the world of NASCAR, speak out on behalf of immigrant rights and speak about his own immigrant experience, that says that something bigger is going on here than just a particular sports league catering to its particular audience. So you see a broad reflection, but certainly in the NBA, where players do come from a specific set of experiences that I would argue are rather different than the ones that Steve Bannon is representing, you are going to see that resistance reflect itself more sharply.
Finally, maybe it's just that the NBA is smarter than the rest of the world in that they figured out, you want to get attention? Say something about Trump. I mean, the media figured that out in the early part of the election, and that's probably partly why he's president.
I mean, there's a reason why Stephen Colbert finally has higher ratings than Jimmy Fallon. I mean, they're calling it the Trump bump. And I do think that the NBA senses that on some level, and organizations like Nike corporations sense that on some level. But I also think from talking to a lot of these players that their resistance is sincere and they figure, hey, I've got a platform. I'm going to use it.
Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Check it out. I am the ultimate badass.
Houston, we got a pretty large bang there associated with a master alarm.
Express elevator to hell. Going down.
He's in it for the money, not the science.
You're right, Wyatt. They got me good.
Hey, I think this guy's a couple cans short of a six-pack.
The actor Bill Paxton, who we lost over the weekend.
Yes, at the age of 61, I think. Very sad.
Very sad. Complications to surgery, we heard. The 89th Academy Awards took place Sunday night, and it acknowledged Bill Paxton's loss, and there was much to acknowledge. After 2 years of racial sensitivity and controversy, Jimmy Kimmel, terrified though he was, had actually a pretty good time up there, I thought. And everything went totally smoothly. I mean, nothing screwed up at all, right?
No, it was totally smooth.
You want to just tell me? I didn't stay up.
Oh, you missed that, John. Smooth sailing up until the very end. Of course, La La Land wins six Academy Awards: Best Director for Damien Chazelle, Best Actress for Emma Stone. Everything's going swimmingly. Then it wins Best Picture. Jordan Horowitz, the producer, gets up and gives this joyous, jubilant, grateful speech. And then this happens.
Guys, I'm sorry. No, there's a mistake.
Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
Moonlight, Best Picture.
People in show business, I mean, you know, they take their clothes off. They put their clothes on. They're comfortable no matter what happens. They can handle it. We can't.
You got to say.
They're special people.
A lot of grace under pressure there. Jordan Horowitz was very graceful. He actually had to hold up the winning card to the cameras to prove to everyone that this was not some kind of joke. Poor Warren Beatty, who made the mix up with the envelopes. But everyone handled it very nicely, I thought.
The show itself was very interesting. It was more focused on the stars and the sort of beauty of L.A. and Hollywood. There were great moments, the tour bus coming through.
Yes.
Some of the speeches were really sweet. And there was, you know, the the talk about why didn't we know about the Hidden Figures women from the NASA film, which was so fantastic.
Yes.
You know, all these things, very emotional. I thought the show was pretty successful.
Yeah, I did too. All things considered, I think a lot of people expected and perhaps feared that there would be a lot of political grandstanding on stage. You didn't get that. You did see a lot of nods to politics, things about immigration and things like that. But mostly, I think people kind of kept it personal. They kept their speeches very heartfelt and personal. Viola Davis, who won Supporting Actress for Fences,
very,
you know, said very, very long and
yeah.
emotional speech. And,
yeah,
and they let her go with it,
yeah,
too, because she was so into it.
They did. What about the indie movies that really seem to take a lot of the attention? I mean, you had great, you know, blockbusters, but you know, Manchester by the Sea, I mean,
right.
did an amazing job.
Right, Casey Affleck winning for Manchester by the Sea, a much deserved, I would say. And it was a great night for Moonlight, obviously. I mean, an indie film. You know, in some ways, you could almost call La La Land an indie film, too. That's a low-budget musical. You know, not exactly an indie film. It's not a modest, tiny budget. But
risks,
was,
experiments, yeah. you know, taking, yeah. I just love that.
Yeah, I do, too. And I think, you know, I think La La Land got most of the Oscars that it deserved. And I think Moonlight did, too. And I was kind of one thing we don't talk about here, because the big mix up was how odd it is to see Best Director go to La La Land, but Best Picture go to Moonlight. Sort of an interesting way to split the difference there, I thought.
Well, it's a kind of a crazy political controversy that they always have every year at
yes,
the
indeed.
Oscars, that's for sure. But they're two fantastic movies. People should see both of them. Rafer Guzman, we'll do it all again
yes,
next
we will.
Year, won't we? Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, reporting on the 89th Academy Awards. Thanks so much, Rafer.
Thanks, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists working with university researchers to explore new areas in human cognition. Learn more at lumosity.com. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors, and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
We have problems talking about race in America. While some talk, others live it. We have problems talking about white privilege in America. While some talk, others live it. Trying to reach across the black-white divide contains a risk. Hey, anger will get you nowhere. Oh, look at how racially sensitive I am. Quit patronizing me. Maybe you should talk less and listen more. Do you know anything about our history? Who owns history? Hey, there's been lots of progress. You have to agree with that, right? These well-meaning words collide all the time. You've probably heard them before. But right now, there is a rethinking of reconciliation and people, white and African-American, are taking more risks to reach each other in words, spoken and written. We have made it our business to cover these conversations and even to instigate some of them. A few months ago, a thought-provoking essay ran on Time.com, and it caught our eye. It was written by best-selling author Jodi Picou. Her latest book, Small Great Things, has her speaking from the point of view of some African-American characters. Not many authors do this successfully, but Picou's book sold well and was well-reviewed. She wrote an essay for Time about her experiences confronting race and racism as a privileged white woman in America. Her words were perfect, uncomfortable truths for our reporting project. Conversations and thoughts about race that take writers out of their day-to-day lives. Did Picou cross a bridge? Is she just looking for the sensitive white woman award? Well, she took the risk. You can decide.
When my son was 4, we were crossing the Dartmouth campus when we passed an African-American student. "Mommy," Kyle asked, "who is the tan man?" He said this loud enough for the young man to overhear. I turned 10 different shades of red and fell all over myself trying to diffuse the awkwardness. I told my son that although people came in different shades, we're all the same. I told him I was colorblind and he should be too. I was sure this was the right response. I was wrong. A few years before that encounter on the Dartmouth Green, I tried to write about racism. I'd written multiple books from the points of view of people I was not. Holocaust survivors, rape victims, school shooters, men. Why was it so hard for me to write from the point of view of someone black? Because race is different. Racism is different. It's hard to discuss without offending people. As a result, we often choose not to discuss it at all. I could not ask my readers to reevaluate their own prejudice and privilege until I confronted my own, which is why this novel was the hardest book I've ever written. I began by thinking back to my childhood in suburbia. I didn't have black friends, but surely that was because I could count on one hand the number of African Americans in my school of 2,400, right? My parents were Jewish, upper middle class, generous and kind and not prejudiced. Yet I could distinctly remember watching the evening news as my parents offhandedly referred to an African American on the screen with the Yiddish word schwarz. At the time, I thought it was simply descriptive. It literally means black. But now, I saw it clearly as a pejorative, a label that separated them from us. I reflected on my relationship with race as I grew older. The first black friends I made went to Princeton with me. There was one girl, Lisa, a poet in my creative writing class, whose writing I loved. We'd walk back to campus after our workshops. I learned about her upbringing in suburban Chicago, which sounded a lot like my own. I talked to her about boys, about our professors, about writing, but never about race. I had been the first to praise myself for not seeing color when I was at college. How open-minded I was! How racially progressive! But was that true? Or had I just been ignorant? Had I ever bothered to ask Lisa what it felt like to be in her shoes? To be the only black person in a seminar? To feel the professor's eyes light on you whenever a writer of color was mentioned? No, because I never had to. I started reading books and articles by social justice educators and activists. Michelle Alexander, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Beverly Daniel Tatum, Melissa Harris Perry, Debbie Irving, Peggy McIntosh, Shelley Tuchluk. I met with women of color who graciously overlooked my ignorance and shared with me the stories of their lives, from their fears for their children to the microaggressions they face daily. A woman of color my age asked me how often I talked about racism with my kids at the dinner table. Occasionally, I replied, which, to be honest, was an overestimation. I asked her how often she talked about racism at the dinner table. Every night, she said. Here is the grievous mistake I had made for the majority of my life. I assumed that racism is synonymous with bias. Yet you could take every white supremacist and ship him off to Mars, and you'd still have racism in the world. That's because racism is systemic and institutional, but it is both perpetuated and dismantled in individual acts. Racism is the white lady standing in line at the bus stop who moves her purse to the opposite side when a black man comes to wait beside her. It's the fact that if you're black and convicted of a crime, justice may not be so just. It's the realization that although people of color can likely name three shampoos that white people use, the reverse is rarely true. One of the many things I've learned is that the role of the white ally isn't to be a savior or a fixer. It's to find other white people and make them understand that many of the benefits they've enjoyed in life are a direct result of the fact that someone else did not have those same benefits. Once I started to see my privilege more clearly, I realized my role was to open the eyes of people who looked like me. For 47 years of my life, I did not discuss race. Now I talk about it all the time. Yes, it is often awkward and uncomfortable. But you know, comfort isn't an entitlement. In fact, many people of color feel uncomfortable every day. In other words, if starting this dialogue makes you uneasy, it means you're doing something right.
That's Jodi Picco, author of Small Great Things. Her full essay appeared on Time.com last October.
This is James, and I'm calling from the University of Pittsburgh. Every day, I try to learn more about other cultures through books, conversations, and multimedia. It's difficult, but your views and biases can only change with knowledge.
My name's Samantha from Missouri. I grew up in a pretty solidly white southern town. I've always been a person who tries to be as progressive as possible, but some things you just don't even realize are ingrained from your childhood. There have been times in my life where I instinctively chose to walk on the side of the street with white people as opposed to any other race. I realize little things like this as soon as they happen and think about it logically, but the instinct is there, and that's a lot harder to change than anything else.
From Honolulu, as a child, I'm black from the American South. I noticed that I had a preference for partners with lighter skin. Coming from a family that runs the gamut of skin shades, that did not sit well with me. So I made an effort to point out beauty in every darker potential partner I saw. We want to hear from you about your biases, what you've discovered about yourself. We want you to participate and tell your story. Visit thetakeaway.org/truths and tell us who you'd like to have a difficult talk about race with. Could be a friend, a family member, a coworker. We want to hear it. And as always, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page. We're going to make this country better. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.